Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio. You know, every fourth Saturday, we get to chat with Glenn Burrows. Glenn is a family history expert and tour guide and owner of Norfolk Tours in East Anglia, England. And you can go to his website, norfolk-tours.co.uk, and also read his articles on blendradio and tv.com. And today, you know what? It's Memorial Weekend. But, you know, this is a subject that I don't think it should just always be Memorial Day weekend. Something we can talk about always is military history. And today is going to talk about World War II airfields, but they're USA airfields in Norfolk, England. So welcome back, Glenn. How are you?
Oh, fantastic here. We've had a bit of rain, but it's lovely over here.
It's that time of year. That's just gorgeous. Well, green.
Exactly. We are so green over here at the moment. It's untrue. It's
beautiful. So this is a good time of year to visit airfields.
Oh, it is. Yeah. I mean, actually, a lot of airfields are now farms. So when you go onto the airfield, if you get permission, which obviously I can sort out, you're obviously in the middle of a farm. So this time of the year, there's a lot of early growth corn. So the corn is about that high. I'm talking about, wheat, barley, cereals. And there's also a lot of rape. I think you call it canola.
Yeah, canola.
The beautiful yellow. I mean, the yellow in the countryside at the moment is just amazing. All the rape fields. Absolutely beautiful. Lovely time. Lovely time. And also, we're coming up to hay time. So a lot of airfields are covered in grass because, you know, it grows quite easily. And this is the time of year that they're making hay. So you see a lot of hay fields as well. So it's lovely to see all the activity on the farms.
Very nice. Have you ever been out there baling hay? I mean, that's hard work.
Well, we don't do that anymore. We have these great big machines that do the circular bales, like a great big sausage roll.
Oh yeah,
and you can't move them by hand. You have to have a forklift, like a forklift truck on the front of a tractor, and you put them onto the trailers. I'll take some pictures because my son-in-law is a farmer and he does hay, so I'll do an article on. Hey, but the only problem is it's not smelly vision. There is nothing nicer than the smell of fresh mown hay.
It's true.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, that's a true, but with any photos, you know, it's like you don't get that other sense.
Well, no, actually, you know what? I like the idea of you doing hay, but really, I think I know we're getting into World War II history, but over here, you know, one of the biggest draws people do, like in Central California in certain areas, is they go on farms and farm agritourism. So I think our next conversation should be farm stays. I know you've got lots of bed and breakfasts on farms. Yeah, and so, farmers markets where you can shop for fresh produce that's not in the box store. You know what I mean?
Funny you should say that. This Sunday, now coming up, I'm actually... Buy Local Norfolk is going to have a big stand on one of the local farmers markets in Raynham Hall, which is a beautiful house. And we're going to be in the walled garden. Would you believe that?
We'll see this.
I'll take some pictures.
Yeah, we like this. We like this.
Yeah, that'll be good to talk about.
Because I know Norfolk, you have a lot of farms, you've got agriculture, you've got the coast, right? So when you think of World War II, your positioning for America to come over to England and use you as a base to go over to Europe was pretty much like over to France and Germany. You were kind of like the leaping, like if you could think that Norfolk was like the little spring, that like a little trampoline, America comes with their pilots, jumps off and boings right over the pond.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at a map of England, you know, you see where we are, and it is so useful to get across to Germany, to Holland, and to that Belgian coast. So Norfolk and Suffolk were the go-to place for airfields. Mm. Also with Norfolk and Suffolk, we are relatively flat. So the countryside was perfect for airfields. Mm. And, you know, it was, the position is fantastic because we're right on that east coast, and the countryside was perfect as well because they didn't have to do any major earthworks to flatten the countryside to put airfields in. So, you know, it was wow. the perfect place. In wow. fact, if I just change my background quickly Ooh. into that one, you Ooh. Can see where I am, my little red dot. Mm-hmm. And the coast to the right bottom corner is mm-hmm. Germany and Holland. So from Norfolk, you're just going straight across the North Sea into Germany.
Mm, so it was so
wow,
perfect.
It makes perfect sense to do. But can you tell us a little bit about how and why America decided Norfolk? And it was this part of like the allegiance of everyone getting together in World War II and saying we're gonna nail them. You know, we're gonna take out Hitler and everything that he's doing. Mm-hmm. But America decided, okay, we're aligning ourselves and merging with England on this. And England said, hey, we've got a good spot. Go to Norfolk. Well, you know,
East Anglia was the place that was the, like you say, the trampoline, the jumping off mm-hmm. point. But, you know, soon as America came into Second World War, it needed a base to mm-hmm. base itself. And obviously England was where they needed to be because it was really useful for Europe. Mm-hmm. But East Anglia was perfectly positioned. And, I mean, they did call Norfolk America's aircraft carrier because basically mm-hmm. we were a massive aircraft carrier. I mean, not only for the Americans, but the English had their own mm-hmm. RAF stations as well.
Right.
And a lot of the USAF bases were also shared with English ones as well. So although we've got a lot of English bases, we've got a lot of American bases, but we've also got some that had both. Because obviously once you've got an airfield, you had the runways and all the administration all in place, so you shared it all, you know. Mm. So a lot of these bases were shared between America and England. And well, and Australia, New Zealand, you know, when they came into the war, you know, so we were absolutely inundated with people. I mean, I've put in my article that at any time between 1942 and 1945, mm-hmm. there would have been at least 50,000 people, mm-hmm. American servicemen, in Norfolk at any one time. So sometimes in a couple of 100,000. But there was always around 50,000 American servicemen in Norfolk during the Second wow. World War. Unbelievable. That is a lot of people.
That's like a whole city. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be its own town, like just for
some of these airfields were in such a tiny village that the airfield became much, much bigger than the village. You know, at the time, you know, because you've suddenly got an influx of over 1,000 people in a village that probably only had 200 people living in it.
Mm,
so you can imagine what impact that had on the local population. You know, you can imagine how good the publicans felt about it because all of these people suddenly came in and had a glass of beer.
Well, but it's like what you said. I mean, what about the accommodations for them? I mean, suddenly you have to build these airfields, and you gave a really good list of who was actually using these airfields, so people doing their family history can look at who the different, you know, the different battalions were, and bomb groups, really, right? Yeah. And so that's a really cool thing for people to use. Hey, Jimmy Stewart was part of this. I'm just saying.
He was. Yeah.
But where, I mean, did they create like a little, like here in the States, when you go to military bases, it's like its own city. They have a commissary. They mm-hmm. have restaurants. I mean, they even have McDonald's and stuff on them. And then they have their own housing, and then there's housing on the outside and schools. And so what was it like then, suddenly having a small village, like maybe 100, 200 people, and suddenly here comes thousands of people, and here comes the airfields need to be built. We're going to change the land. But everybody, it was for the greater good, right? So everybody was on that. We're going to do whatever we can do. But where did people stay? I mean, you didn't have like, you know, the Hyatt Hotel at that point.
No, what actually happened was they came to an area. They built, first of all, they built the perimeter track, which is the track that goes all the way around the airfield. And to do that, they obviously needed some accommodation. And they started off by having these Nissen huts, which could be put up in a day. It's basically a piece of corrugated iron like that with a brick this end and brick that end. So you've got a tube, you know, you've got a tube like that. And they just put them up as accommodation. So it was just very, very basic. So they would build the Nissen huts, and then they would bring the men in to build the airfield itself. And then they would build brick-built accommodation blocks. To start off with, they built the accommodation blocks near the airfield. And then they realized that they were putting the personnel at risk. So they then dispersed the accommodation blocks into the community. So, for instance, at Wendling, which is where my son-in-law farms, the airfield is in the middle of a field, but most of the accommodation was in the village of Beeston, which is next door. It's another village. So they were like half a mile, a mile up the road is where most of the personnel were living. So it was, you know, if the airfield was attacked, you wouldn't kill all the men. You might lose a few, obviously, and you might lose the runway, and you might lose a few aircraft, but you wouldn't lose all your men because they were a mile up the road.
Okay. So,
although it was a very, very quick thing. I mean, when you imagine how much work was going on, it was an unimaginable project to get this all done in time, but it was done so quickly and everything was just thrown up. But they were actually quite good quality buildings, because some of these hangars are still in use today.
Wow.
I could take you to a dozen hangars that are still used. A lot of the buildings are still used today. I could take you to two dozen Second World War American buildings that are still standing, still used. And again, like I've shown in my pictures, there are loads of them that are just standing, falling down in woods. And, you know, it's just amazing how much is still there. You know, the control towers, a lot of them are still just standing in the middle of a field.
Unbelievable. That's amazing to think, and how fast, you know, because in this kind of, and it's not like how we can just call someone on a cell phone or send a text or a Facebook message, right? So the communication back then too, I mean, it's just, you got to think about what we had,
like,
versus
horseback, the mail system, which could take weeks.
Didn't they have telegraphs then? Telegrams?
Oh yeah. They had trains and they had lorries, or trucks, or whatever you want to call them. But can you imagine having to build 20, 30, 40 airfields, complete airfields, not just a runway, a whole airfield, and multiply that by 20, 30, 40, you know, that is a lot of logistics.
And then they have to bring the planes over from America, or did you guys have planes for the Americans?
Well, we did have some. But actually, the Americans brought all theirs with them, all the liberators and, you know, everything.
Yeah, you got the liberator behind you.
I have. This one's in Duxford Museum, which is a fantastic air museum. It's all about the air and the army as well, just outside Cambridge. Absolutely fantastic. It's got any sort of American. In fact, when I was there with a Second World War Liberator pilot, amazing. Wow. 93 he was. He was running around just like a spring chicken. He put me to shame. I took him to Duxford. And as we were standing by the runway, you know the Memphis Belle, the aeroplane that was in the film?
Yeah.
They were getting that ready to take off because it was then going off to an air show. And he used to fly them as well as these Liberators.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And he was telling me what they were doing in the cockpit.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Amazing is that? Eh?
Oh, that's awesome.
Still send shivers up the back of my neck.
Yeah. I bet. You know, it's interesting because it ties, you know, I think about World War One is when we started having actual air combat, know, and in America, it was the Yale students. I think you were on that one interview that we did. Oh boy, I'll have to look it up again, but I think it was Hardwick or something. I think.
Yeah, Hardwick is on there. Yeah.
Yeah, that there were a group of students in Yale who said, well, we're going to start flying. That's one way to take these suckers out is go out. And this was World War One. And they started, they used the coast of Florida. And I think they came over to England. So it was kind of like, did World War One help World War Two, like help the airfields, help them know what to do for the airfields, like from the beginnings? Well, because World War One, it was just like, they didn't even start with air attacks.
In World War One, they mainly had grass airfields, so they didn't need the great big runways because they didn't have the great big aircraft. But it sort of put things into place because they knew roughly what they were doing. And really, with World War Two, if you think about what the situation was at the start of World War Two, think how quickly aircraft developed over those 6 years. It's unbelievable how quickly they grew and how the knowledge grew and how they had to adapt. Because when they first started, airfields were, you know, a certain size. But then when the bigger aircraft came along, which they did, they then had to make the runways longer because they weren't long enough for the aircraft to take off. And, and all of this happened within 6 years. Well, 6 years is a tiny amount of time. And the development of aircraft over that time is just unbelievable. I mean, World War II started with sort of propellers.
Yeah.
At the end of it, the jet aircraft was starting to, it didn't get into action, but it was starting to be developed. You know, unbelievable the speed of development in aircraft technology. You know, it really is.
And now look,
that went faster than the development of the airstrips and air landing places and airports. The planes were way ahead of the airports. Were.
But you see, so many airports are now on what were airfields, because Norwich Airport used to be an airfield. Heathrow Airport used to be an airfield.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So a lot of these World War II airfields are now our airports because the infrastructure is there. You know, Norwich Airport used to be a World War II airfield.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So when you go, I mean, you can go to some of, you said like, I mean, it's, you've got your museums, but then if you want to go, like, say I've got family, and who knows, maybe we do, you know, never know. Everyone, you got to look at that list on Glenn's article.
Yeah, you never know.
And just so you know, Glenn's article is linked from the show notes. But when you look at that list and maybe, you know, see if you see anything that connects to your family, research it. But and someone calls you up and says, hey, Glenn, I saw, you know, this bomb group and, you know, I had a great, great grandfather or something that was in there. I want to go visit. I mean, it's not like they're all museums, right? So what's the experience like for someone wanting to do it? Can you take him to where it once was, or, you know, here's Heathrow.
I mean, generally speaking, most airfields are not open to the public because they're on farmland. I mean, the one over your shoulder, you can just see the cross of the two runways. That is in the middle of farmland. So that's on private property. But 99% of farmers who own property, which includes an old airfield, will be more than pleased to allow people on, you know, who are connected. I mean, like I said, my son-in-law farms on what used to be an airfield, and he is thrilled to bits if someone contacts him, obviously normally through me, and says, can I visit and have a look? He's thrilled to bits. I mean, the other, several years ago now, I think, I contacted somebody on one of the Facebook pages for the 8th Air Force, and he said that his uncle, I think it was, actually served on my son-in-law's airfield.
Wow.
And he said, do you think you could send me a piece of the runway? So I said to my son-in-law, can I nick a piece of concrete? And he was thrilled. He was thrilled to bits.
Yeah, but you know, who goes around saying, can I nick a piece of concrete? I like that.
Yeah, really. That's so funny.
He was thrilled to bits that this person was interested enough. So I sent him a piece of the tarmac from the actual runway, you know, because
that's part of it.
His family history, you know. Obviously, if we can't let everybody come and steal a piece of concrete, but
this is how history lives on.
Yes.
It's by people remembering or honoring or checking out who their ancestors were.
Yes.
And what they did and why they did that, you know, and where do you come from? Who are your people?
It also perpetuates it to the younger generation. I mean, my son-in-law is only, what is he? He's 36. So obviously he's got nor have I. I haven't got any memory of the Second World War. But, you know, it brings it home to him that his farm was home to a lot of Americans, and his farm was home to a lot of Americans who never went home again.
Yeah, that's something. I was going to ask you that. You know, this is so much history there, and if people can't, I know you've got Norfolk tours. You take people around, and like someone says, "Hey, I've got my family history," and you'll take them to all those and help them research it, and go to the church, the cemetery, maybe you know where the old house they lived in or whatever it is with their ancestors. Yeah. But when it comes to the airfield, so if someone says, "Hey," you know, I know there's this airfield. Will you help them like make contact with the farmer, or you help set up, hey, I'm going to take you to this airfield.
Yeah.
But what happens if someone doesn't or is unable to travel? Because some people are still scared to, depending on their age and health and even finances, right? So do you ever, you know, just help people with family history and help them do the research, since you're so connected and you know family history like the back of your hand, you know?
Of course.
So can you help them just on that capacity?
Yes, of course. I do often help people with family history on its own. And obviously, if you're in America and you've got a connection with, we'll say, Hardwick Airfield, I can go to Hardwick Airfield and video Hardwick Airfield. You know, I can actually go there for you and have a look round and show you all around the airfield as if you were there. Obviously, you're not there, but I can take photos of the buildings. I can video and show you around whatever's in the countryside and, you know, do the next best thing. But, you know, it is important if you can to come over, because you then get the connection,
the real set, and you're stepping there. And if you're there, make sure you tell Glenn to take his pick so he can nick a piece of concrete.
Well, there's always, when you go somewhere, there's always that, I always like think of it as your sixth sense, where you get that feeling.
Yes.
You know, and you can't really, you just get a feeling.
It is all about the atmosphere, the connection, you know. You cannot get a connection if you're not there.
But
you know, I know there are a lot of people who can't, and I have done this. I mean, I remember this is a lot of years ago, but this lady contacted me and said, you know, can you take a load of photos of this village And I took, that was at the time when you still had films. So I took two whole films of photos of this particular village for her.
Oh, cool.
Because she couldn't travel. But, you know, that was what she wanted. And that was, I was thrilled to bits to do it for her. But yeah. You know, there is nothing like visiting. I mean, it's like when I went to Halifax in Nova Scotia, because where my ancestor had been in 1815, I had that feeling I was where he was. You know, he came back to England after that, or, you know, or I wouldn't have been here. But, you know, he'd been there. I got there by aeroplane, but he got there by boat.
That's crazy, man. And it's crazy.
Yeah.
Also interesting, like, you know, when we talk about ships and boats and airfield, you know, transportation history, and then in wars. What I'm finding now is, like, you're seeing a lot of people doing cruises, like river cruises on barges, like these ancient, like, so now in Norfolk, you've got the canals. That's something people can do, like, on a little boat. What do you call it? Is it, you don't have the broads, excuse me. The broads. No, not women.
Norfolk Broads, we've got,
yeah. Nancy, it sounds like the movie we watched last night. Nobody needs to see that. It
sounds like a casino. The Norfolk Broads.
No, and that's but it's beautiful.
Yes.
So do you have, like, historic boats that people can float on the on the Broads?
We do. We have. In fact, I had a lady over from Australia who was writing a novel about medieval monasteries, and actually this monastery that's in the middle of the Broads was only accessible by boats in medieval times, and now you can drive to it, but it's down a dirt track, you know, so the easiest way to get to it really is by boat. So what I did is I arranged that we would go on a little 1930s sailing boat, and we would sail along the Broads. So she would get an idea for her novel, because a writer needs that.
Yeah, the visuals.
And she was thrilled to bits that we were sailing. Yeah. So she got the sound of the water, the sound of the sun, you know, all of that. And the best thing she said, which was really funny, it absolutely poured with rain. We were both drenched through to our underwear. And she was thrilled because she said she couldn't have got that without going out on the water.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
She got that to put in her book. You know,
I want to read her book now.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, the medieval monk who would have got soaked, you know, that is something that she felt because she was there on an old sailing boat.
Mm. You know, and so she knows what it feels like. So, and it's hard to write. It's hard to write about something, even if you're writing fiction, to write about something that you've never experienced.
Yeah.
Especially if it's fiction, but it's still something that really happened. You know, if you're going to be accurate.
But do you have to know the basic feels of wind and rain and
She said that she couldn't have wanted anything better than to get completely drenched.
That's funny. I love that.
Nancy and I do that often. Can you hire someone to sail the boat for you?
Because
you don't want me doing that.
I can't sail. We had a go. Okay. Both of us had a go, but we had someone sailing it for us.
Okay.
Well, they let you to play with the rudder.
No. We had a go at tacking. Was it calling tacking? Going up and down the river. Yeah, it was great.
Playing with the sails then.
Yeah, well, what about when Hyacinth Bouquet went out in the keeping up appearance and she went overboard?
So I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen? I'm going to look that up. Everyone, Hyacinth Bouquet from Are You Being Served? No, not Are You Being Served. Keeping Up Appearances.
Keeping up appearances.
Goes out on a boat with Richard. And it's this little boat and she went overboard and it was the best.
That's so funny.
Hyacinth overboard is fantastic, but I wanted to get into that history because, like, I know we've talked about historic ships before,
You've obviously, you said this museum here has, you know, the Liberator, but so what happens to, obviously, those who were shot down and the planes were shot down, sadly, the, you know, they're resting, hopefully in peace. But what happens, you know, because in this country, we have a lot of boneyards, military planes where you can go see the historic planes. Some of them get sold to the enemies. That, like, there's planes. I know from Mike Guardia being on the show, he's like, well, the F-14 went to Russia, then Iran, and, you know, places we'd go like, what, how did that happen? And I may have the wrong plane, just to say, don't come after me on that. I'm not the expert, but I know that they swap hands between countries. So I'm curious about, here's these airfields. Do any of the airfields even have an actual plane there? Like the remnants of one? Or
I'm trying to think. I mean, yes, I mean, there's one airfield. I think it was Thorpe Abbotts. They've got a lovely museum at Thorpe Abbotts. I think, if I remember rightly, I think Thorpe Abbotts was the 100th bomb group. Let me have a look. Yeah, it was. Well, my brain works.
Oh, you go.
Yay.
The 100th bomb group. They've got a fantastic museum, and I think it's Thorpe Abbotts. And they've got quite a few of the sort of crashed aircraft, little bits. And also bits of aircraft that they've dug up in excavations. And they've also got, you know, reconstructions of different parts of the buildings. And they've got the control tower, which is, you know, there. You know, so, I mean, a lot of these airfields have got things that are there still from the war. But really, if you want to see the sort of the full collection of aircraft, Duxford is actually the place to go, because they have, you know, the Spitfire, the Hurricane, they have the Lancaster, they have all the American aircraft, all of the American aircraft, because, you know, it is the actual building that one is in is full of American aircraft.
Oh, wow.
And also they have a lot of them that fly. I mean, you can even have a flight in a Spitfire if you want. I can arrange that, you know. Wow. So, you know, there are.
I want to be on a Spitfire.
Well, I can arrange it. I want it.
You know, but, and I bring this up because we were going up the coast of California last year, around this time, earlier, and we were in Crescent City, which is known for having a tsunami hit them, right?
Yeah. But every 20 years.
What I'd forgotten, we'd been so all over this country, you know, and having even, you know, lived in Southern California, been up Northern California, but all these interviews with you and history experts have gotten in my brain, and it just dawned on me when we were there. So they have all up the Northern coast, so much World War II history because of the nuclear, there's nuclear history, obviously Pearl Harbor. So that was the launching pad there, right? For the Pacific Theater. And so going up there now, having more knowledge in my head, I was like, oh my gosh. And they're having all these memorials. And then the one memorial had a piece of submarine that had obviously been blown up or something. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, I can't even put into words what that felt like to stand there and go, you know, somebody was underwater in this submarine and something went down. And so here they managed to salvage this piece of floating piece of metal that if you just saw it, if I saw a floating piece of metal in the water, I'd go like, dude, it's a floating piece of metal. What was that? You know, but it turns out it's a submarine from World War II. And, you know, some of the stories we've got for this weekend's broadcast on Memorial Day is how ships were blown up. We blew up our own ships unknowingly, you know. I'm not meaning to. And so I was like, I want to know what happened to the submarine. So now, you know what, I'm going to have to do something on the submarine. But it's in our park. And so that's the thing. When you see something like that, you can only imagine what the men went through in a submarine. I mean, come on. That's some scary stuff. The submarine thing.
The idea of going down and saying like, okay, if you go on a submarine ride and you pay a few dollars and they take you down for an hour or two and you see fish and you come back up, that's one thing. But to go live on a submarine with a bunch of people that you don't really know, for day in and day out, day in and day out.
Well, look at the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, and traveling to countries that you don't normally go to, and to be part of warfare. I mean, it's amazing that people came out of that alive and still sane.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think what you've just said has hit the nail on the head. Sane. How can you go through something like that and get through it? You know, this bloke who came over with his daughter, he was 93, and he used to fly the Liberators and, you know, loads of other aircraft, obviously. He was only 19 when he started.
That's,
you know,
too young.
And how did he go through all of that? You know, he lost people. You know, he lost his. We actually went to my son-in-law's farm, because although he was stationed at Shibdham, which is just up the road from me, his cousin was actually stationed at Wendling, which is where my son-in-law is. And he lost his cousin, who was stationed at Wendling. So we went to Wendling and had a look around, obviously, and we went to the war memorial at Wendling, because all of these airfields have got their own memorials, all of them.
Yeah.
You know, that is one thing, that every airfield has got its own memorial to the men who got.
Oh, that's awesome, though.
But, you know, to think that he was over here all this way from his homeland, and he was only a kid, for God's sake, 19.
Yeah. 19 is too young.
And he lost his cousin over here, you know. He said he remember biking over from Shibdham to Wendling, which is a few miles, to see his cousin. And, you know, his cousin didn't come back from the war. But it's this, isn't it? It's this, this mental.
How much can you see that is repulsive and against every thing you believe in, and come out okay?
I mean, if you've got to think about all of the people. I mean, for instance, I've got one lot of figures there again about Thorpe Abbotts. There were 306 missions. They lost 229 planes.
Wow.
And they had 785 men killed or missing in action.
Wow.
And that is only one of the airfields in Norfolk. And that's only one.
Wow.
And they had 894 who were taken as prisoners of war from airfield. You know, so the morning when they have the get together and they say, right, we're going to fly to such a place and drop some bombs. The next day they come back and say, well, where's Fred? Oh, I don't know. Where's John? Don't know. Where's, you know?
Yeah.
Can you imagine getting up in the morning and not knowing whether you're going to come home at night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your friends are in it together, and you save each other's lives, you know? You know, and I encourage everyone to listen to our new weekly Blend show on Sunday morning, the day after our interview with Glenn, within hours, and listen to one of our friends' stories of his great-grandfather, very heroic story. Absolutely incredible, isn't it, Nancy? Mike Dunmire's story of his great-grandfather. Mm. And so I can't share it with you now because you have to hear it when it comes out. But, you know, that's the thing. You go to these places that are so important, you know, with us, when we started our Love Your Parks tour across America, doing mostly national park units, our National Park Service with the monuments, they do so much on military history, battlefields. So going on a battlefield is so,
it's hard. Emotional.
It's hard, but important. But what we found, and we have to make this map still, Nancy, our Memorial Park map, and we have military centers we've been to are truly, I don't know if the word is humbling, but you just feel, I think that's a word for it. You just feel, wow. You do feel small in there, like, you know, and honor.
It brings it more alive. That if you go to one of these places and you visit, it brings it more alive than only reading about it. It is important to read about it and to know about it. Absolutely. But I really believe, you know, I was just thinking about when I was a kid and we went on field trips through school. Did we go to any field trips that would prepare you or bring you close to the war? No, we did not. Okay. We went fun places. Now I'm looking back and I get it to a certain degree because we were only kids, but I also feel like that memorial monuments and centers should be part of field trips for students so that they can actually, because when you actually physically go to a memorial, you start to feel something and then you start to question, and they do a really good job in giving you the history right there so you can understand what's happening, and then you get an interest in history and at some point you'll put it all together.
It's all about putting it all into context.
Yeah, you put it all together.
I mean, that's what I do with the local primary school as we walk into the village, and we look at different things. You know, we look at the houses, we look at the church, we look at the streets, we look at how the fields are laid out, and then we come back and we talk about it and we learn about why is the field that shape? You know, why does the road go from there to there? You know,
yeah.
All of those sort of things. Then the children start to actually question what they're seeing, because it's all well and good looking at a field or looking at why is there a tree in the middle of that field. Well, actually, when we walk across the field on the footpath, we then realize, if we look at an old map, that's where the field boundary used to go, because there used to be a hedge across there. And then when they made a great big field out of it, they kept the tree in the middle. But the tree is there because that's where there used to be a field boundary. And all of these sorts of things then make the children think, oh, well, that's why that's there. Well, I wonder why that's over there. Mm-hmm. And it's all about putting things into context. And then you can then appreciate things and you can understand. And then you, like Lisa has already said, she wants to research that submarine. It then makes you want to do things because you want to put that piece of metal in context with the submarine.
And you want to know.
And think about who were the men in that submarine? You know, what did they go through? Where did they come from? You know, I mean, I've sent some pictures to go along with the article of some metal tags. And these metal tags have just been ploughed up on the farm. They've just been ploughed up and the farmer has kept them. And actually, they belonged to people who served at Wendling during the Second World War. Wow. And they would have been hung on the board inside the hangar so that whoever came into the hangar would know who was on duty. Now, those people are real people. And I've already carried a load of research about them, but I'd love to know more about them. I'd love to have a photo of them.
You know,
one of them only died in 2002. So there must be a picture of him. You know, so it's them sort of things that is all about putting history into real life.
And everyone has a story, right? And that's the thing. There's always a story behind everything. And, you know, when I remember going to that park, it was a community park. And that's what I think is so great about cities doing memorials to those who served from their country or those visiting, like, you know, what you're talking about, the memorials for the Americans that, you know, worked with England on this. And when you're there, it's just sombering. You know, it's this beautiful park, grassy fields for kids to play in, swings, flowers, a beautiful ocean view, you know. But then they have the different, you know, military memorials. And then, you know, then there's the flag. Now, everybody's got their thing about flags these days and whatever. I'm not getting political about it, but there is something about a flag flying and the symbol, or having, you know, we've been to so many memorials. There's that one in Angel Fire, New Mexico, for David Westfall. And they have, you know, bronze sculptures of Vietnam soldiers and with their, you know, machinery and the actual helicopters and things. And when you see these things or the piece of submarine, it's just really, like I say, humbling, overwhelming, but there's something that goes through your body with the flag just flying as well. There's just something about that, that you just, I think people should kind of go back to feeling those things.
Well, I don't, you know, think
and getting
don't
those, take the stop out, like Memorial Weekend here, we are honoring our military, should be something integrity, not, but, hey, come buy a couch for 50% off, which has become a big sales thing. And it's also become a thing of, when are we going to barbecue? But, it's the unofficial start to summer. So I just kind of, I get it, but I just kind of feel like if we go to these places, well, we will, and have to just take those moments, some moments of silence to think about those at the memorial. You don't need, you know, the politicians or presidents and prime ministers and kings, queens, whatever it all is, to say, okay, now we all have a collective community memorial, you know, moment of silence. I think it's a good thing, to it's educational and gets people to do something, but just go there and think about who this was, like what Glenn was saying, maybe research it later, but just have that, you just even think about them. You can imagine who they are, make up your own story.
Yeah.
It'll give you that feeling, well, and maybe we'll calm down as human beings, you know, and be
but
nicer.
You know, like when we look at Memorial Day, I don't know how many families isn't in some way between themselves now and their ancestors touched by someone who hasn't served or died in action. And maybe remember
disabled.
Maybe remember them.
When I was just outside Cambridge last year, I went to Maddingley. If you look it up, it's Maddingley, just outside Cambridge. And that is the American World War II cemetery. And that is where all the American servicemen who were returned to England are buried. And it is an amazing, heart-rending, you know, it just is a massive cemetery, and it is beautiful in its own way. But that's just outside Cambridge, and that is just for American servicemen who died during the Second World War. So, you know, there are lots and lots of memorials, but Maddingley is actually where most of them are actually buried. Wow. So, you know, that is a place to go. And it is immaculate, absolutely beautiful. But it's like all the graveyards in Normandy. You know, I've been to several of the graveyards in Normandy, and they are just amazing. But again, they're amazing, but it's just heartrending to just see just a whole field of white stones.
Right.
All
isn't it?
Just people, you know, all of those people, you know, and that is just, what did they die for? You know, when you look at it today, you think, if they could come back today, would they think it was worth it? I don't know.
I know. I think that's why it's so important to get the stories while we can, you know, like Mike Guardia, what he does with his books, telling the stories of, and not everybody that's the famous people either, you know.
No, getting
the family story, the human story behind, you know, what happens with those who serve and sacrifice their lives. So I really appreciate it. But Glenn, thank you so much. I think Nancy's hopefully coming back. She's having pollen is flying everywhere. There's a gardener outside doing stuff, and both of us are dying from pollen.
It's
you know, it's the sign of spring. So she'll come back to life at some point. But thank you so much, Glenn. Again, everyone, Glenn's article is up on blendradioandtv.com, but we have it linked in the show notes from whether you're watching this on YouTube and seeing Nancy cough herself silly, or if you're listening on Spotify or bigblendradio.com. It's all in the show notes. But of course, more importantly, go to norfolk-tours.co.uk to keep up with Glenn there. He's also on Facebook and Twitter. So thank you so much, Glenn.
Thanks, girls. See you later.